This is the October 15 edition of Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities out of Watseka, Illinois. Chip Nellinger joins us from Blue Reef Agri Marketing in Morton, Illinois. And Mike Zuzulow is here from GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Our special guest for the day is Danielle Anderson. She's in Hennepin, Illinois, and the director in Government and Public Relations at Marquis Energy. That's an ethanol plant there, and the vice president, or a vice president, I should say, of the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find it online, listen to it on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Let's begin where we normally would by getting a list of items we should discuss for the day. I think Chip Nellinger, I'll start with you today.
Yeah, well, I think front and center is how long is this Chinese demand going to last? How long is this incredible performance in our grain markets set to last? And how much more upside is there even in the face of a really large harvest? So it's been an incredible market action. How much longer might we expect things to go on here with Chinese demand and fund activity?
Mike Zuzulow, GlobalComResearch.com.
Yeah, just to dovetail with Chip, the demand rationing that we're doing right now, whether it's a kind of an extra amount, given the fact that we're seeing some pretty big cities around the world go back into a lockdown with COVID, and some of the new IMF data that's come out on the update for their world economic outlook, not as good as I would like to have seen. So does this create an issue?
And Merrill Crowley.
I was going to kind of play the devil's advocate. What could be out there to slow this thing up as far as on the other side, things that we may not be looking at because we're more bullish.
Okay. And then Daniel Anderson, I'd like you to take a moment, if you would, and introduce yourself. Tell me a little bit about your background and what you do at Marquis.
Yes, thank you for having me on today. I look forward to chatting with all of you. At Marquis, I've been with the company for about 4 years. I do the government relations here, work closely on the Illinois level with the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association, and on the policy side, trying to get bills passed, working against some bills here in the state legislature, and do some stuff on the federal level as well, and then also handle the company's communications. Trying to keep up our social media and our presence in the news as well.
Are you located at the plant?
Yes, I'm at the headquarters here in Hennepin, Illinois. We also have a facility in Nisita, Wisconsin. But we're headquartered here. We have over 450 employees. And that's between the two facilities, with the most of them being here in Hennepin. Since we are the world's largest biofuels facility, we make over 1 million gallons of fuel-grade ethanol per day and over 3,000 tons of DDG a day.
Can you tell me how COVID-19 has impacted production over the last several months?
Yes. So when March hit, we pretty immediately saw a cut in production across the board in the industry, and we're looking at about 50% production cut that happened. We had plants curtail, we had plants shut down, and we're now seeing things start to ramp back up a bit, though we are going into the winter months where we see, you know, less driving happening. And that's really what the dip happened, is the fuel consumption just plummeted due to people working from home, not going out as much, staying put. And so that's what we really saw at that big dip there. And the success story, I can say, that came of this is, fortunately, our company in particular, we did not lay anyone off. We did not cut anyone's benefits or had to let anyone go. We pivoted to hand sanitizer in addition to our regular ethanol production. So the nice thing about our industry is we can take a kernel of corn, make it into, you know, clean burning fuel, but the alcohol that is used, this clean alcohol that we can make, we can put that into hand sanitizer, as since it is the main component. in sanitizers and in sanitizing wipes. So you see across the board many people, many of the ethanol industries here in the ethanol companies here in Illinois pivot to some sort of hand sanitizer production, whether they supplied the 40B, the alcohol component, or in our case, we are doing the whole from starting from the alcohol and bottling it and then getting these contracts with some of these companies out there that will be providing hand sanitizers in stores. So we do the white labeling now, and we've put in infrastructure to be able to be a long-term player in that field.
On a percentage, how much of your production is dedicated to hand sanitizer now?
I don't have those exact numbers for you, but we are, our facility in Wisconsin is the main facility providing the 40B. And then here in Illinois is where we're doing all of the bottling of it and getting it to the end user. And we've been lucky to have hired 100 people since March to facilitate that operation.
Mike Susilo, you have a question for Danielle Anderson?
Yes, and Danielle, thanks for joining us. It couldn't have come at a better time for us to get some expertise. I was reading an energy outlook by the International Energy Agency put out today, and just briefly they said in their base case scenario, they're looking at getting back to pre-pandemic energy consumption for the world not until early 2023. Are you looking at any kind of long-term supply chain shifts related to energy demand? In other words, biofuel or fuel ethanol, is that demand that we've lost and we haven't gotten back to since the last 3 or 4 months recovery? Is that something you or your group is kind of forecasting won't come back for a year or two or three? Or are you looking at anything like that right now?
We're always going to take that into consideration. We want to be conservative on all of our decisions. So we're definitely looking out for something like that, that if the levels don't go back up to where they were, we're going to be prepared for that. What I can say is how things have happened internationally. The one thing about Illinois is we are on the Illinois River, and we're able to, our plant specifically and a lot of other plants, they can use the Illinois waterway system to put barges together, go float down to St. Louis, send your ships out globally and get some product out of the U.S. consumption. And that's been wonderful to have. I can't tout the Illinois River enough to be able to have those logistics to get some of our stuff out of this market and provide this clean burning fuel and our dry distillers grains to the livestock across the globe to these high population areas. And I will say that 2 days ago, I don't know if you knew, but we had lot closures. And I think this is the first in 80 years that our river's been shut down. And we've known about this for a couple of years. So we had made plans to go around the river and go to the Mississippi until the river opened back up. And so we are optimistic being able to use the river again and be able to hit those, you know, the European market, these Asian markets, and just a lot of other markets that are developing out there. So I think our last ship to China was in February 2018. And with these Chinese tariffs and the tariff war, we've been completely shut out of that market, which was a huge market for us. There have been other markets that have developed. But we hope for a day where we can get back into some of those larger markets, especially the Asian, you know, the Chinese market. That would be huge for us. And like I said, I can't emphasize much how important the Illinois waterway system is for all of our members here in Illinois, all of the ones that are part of the ethanol industry and floating our distillers grains and floating out our ethanol as well.
Chip Nellinger, you have a follow-up question potentially?
Yeah, just to dovetail on the international aspect, can you quantify for us? It seems like there's always a little bit of a of a black hole, both the ethanol export capacity, and then there's been some rumors here recently that China, as part of this trade agreement, has been looking for potentially U.S. DDGs. And I just wonder if you could comment on maybe what the export capacity or expectations are for both ethanol and DDGs going forward.
We go to the end user. So we're very fortunate to have a marketing team here at our company that goes and travels the globe and meets with these customers, whether it's in Thailand, Turkey, wherever. And we're opening up new markets with our distillers' grains and our ethanol. And a new product that we have that is value added to the corn. We have the dry distillers grains, and we also have now high protein feed that is able to concentrate that protein that's in that kernel of corn, that we're able to take out more of the corn oil. And so we have this concentrated form that that really gives us a value-added commodity as we go across the globe, that especially when you have the chicken, the poultry guys, this is something that they're looking for. And aquaculture now is also looking into this high-protein feed that is starting, that other ethanol companies, as well as us, are going into. So that's opening up some markets as well.
Merrill Crowley, you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, you do a lot of work with the politicians. Which, do you have any favorites that you want in the office to work better with, your ethanol, Democratic or Republican?
We have great, the wonderful thing about Illinois is we have great champions that are on both sides of the aisle. We just recently, we had the Next Generation Fuels Act filed, and that was filed by Democrat Sherry Bustos. But we expect bipartisan support. We have great relationships with Congressman Darren LaHood. We have great relationships with Rodney Davis, Congressman Bost. So we really see this as a bipartisan issue here in Illinois and in other states as well. So, and I don't know if you've heard much about the Next Generation Fuels Act. But what this bill does, it is establishes a minimum fuel octane level of 98 RON, which is a research octane number, which is an increase from today's regular gasoline, which is a 91 RON. And this would support mid-level blends from E15 to E30. So when you go to the gas station, virtually all gas has E10 in it, the blend of 10% ethanol into the fuel. And we are really excited about this opportunity to have more corn demand, more ethanol demand from such a bill as this. And this is a federal bill, but we also have our eyes on some things here on the state side. A few weeks back, President Trump tweeted about that he is lifting restrictions on, we were restricted previously by the infrastructure that you could not sell E15, a 15% blend out of the E10 hoses. And so now he's lifted that restriction and he's kind of made it up to the state. So the Illinois Renewable Fuel Association, we're working on not only the federal level on the octane bill, but we're working here in the state in Illinois to get a bill passed that addresses the infrastructure so that we simply can sell E15 out of E10 hoses, and that's going to be a huge incentive for people at the pump. They want to save about a nickel on each gallon of gasoline in their tank, and that's going to happen when you have the higher blends of ethanol in your fuel, like an E15. So we're really excited about that and hope to get some traction and get that done here shortly.
These are pieces of legislation, both on the federal and the state level, I think, that are not mandates. Is there any reason to think that the industry would be likely to incorporate such a move into the pump, something, a blend above E15, given the restrictions of use in small engines?
So the state bill that addresses the infrastructure is really focused on only that E15 blend because of Trump's tweet and with the federal restrictions, his talks of them being lifted and that we would just initiate on the state level. But that isn't a mandate. That's simply lifting those restrictions. So it leaves it up to the retailer to be able to flip their pumps to handle the E15. But we've never had misfueling. The small engine guys should be happy because we foresee always being an E10 pump available for motorcycles, for your lawnmowers. And then the rest of the pumps can have that E15 to support your vehicle. And that's been tested. So there should never be an issue there, and it will just get you the benefits of lowering greenhouse gas emissions, having that higher octane in your tank as well.
Well, thank you, Danielle. Danielle Anderson, of course, is from Hennepin, Illinois. She is the Director of Government and Public Relations at Marquis Energy. She's also a vice president at the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association. Mike, I think I want to come to you following up from what she's told us about the export market and the importance of it, and of course the importance of domestic demand of ethanol in the gasoline supply here in the United States. You're concerned COVID-19 is on an uprise across the planet again this fall and into the winter months, and that some cities in Europe may be locking down. How do these two things play together, do you think?
Well, I think we can take a kind of a snapshot of what happened to our dairy industry, you know, and the energy industry for that matter, back in the March time period. And Todd, I just cannot forget the idea that we did go negative in crude oil during the heart of that pandemic, and out of position traders that weren't ready for that pandemic. And so I always want to keep that in the back of my mind. But I think, you know, when Paris locks down, when London locks down, when parts of New York are locking down, and we still see about 11 million people out of work here in the United States, I think it's really important to keep an eye out on the updated data. And IMF came out this week, and a couple pieces of data that really caught my eye was that global purchasing managers indexes are coming back. They're up about 2% now from the pre-pandemic time period. So they've really come back nicely. But the merchandise trade, what you and I really care about, it's still, and it is a lagging indicator, but it's still down 5%, which is a bit too big of a number, in my opinion. And probably the worst thing about it is if we do go into a bigger lockdown now and we start to slip economically, I just don't think the economies, the governments of the world can do what they just got done doing as far as throwing a bunch of money at this, because A, it'll, I think, be a little bit too late for a lot of businesses, and B, I think the IMF came out with a G20 global debt of 239% of GDP. The last time we were at this level was back during the Great Recession, and that peak was around 225% of global GDP. So I hate to get in the weeds on this kind of stuff with all these numbers, but the bottom line for me is that I don't think we're in a very good place if these lockdowns last going into the holidays, especially with flu season coming up. And I think we got to keep that in mind as we manage our risk in the commodities.
I suppose it'll be a good indication. France and Germany are locking down in different ways. France already imposing a 9 o'clock, I think, curfew in the evenings. I don't know whether that's gone in place yet or not. Germany not as tight. If I remember correctly, the COVID jump in France is about four times what it is in Germany. So it'll be interesting to see, I think, if the population will lock down, or what they'll be doing, and how that impacts what governments do going forward as well. Chip Nellinger, I want to get right into what we might be doing this fall for farmers. They are in the middle of harvest, of course, and I think all three of you can answer this question if you'd like. We'll start with soybeans. Above $10 for the most part across the Corn Belt. When I talked to Frayne Olson from North Dakota State University on Monday, they were 60 under. So when normally at this time, they're $1 to $1.20 under November futures. So bids have been good. What should producers be doing across the scale, if anything, with soybeans, Chip?
Well, if you look at the spreads in basis, which you touched on, the soybean market is screaming at you to do not store beans under any circumstances, sell them right off of the combine, right out of the field. And I think that's probably just what producers should do, especially in the areas that are blessed with better than average yields. Yields are really variable depending on where you're at. Many people are north of 60. There's many people that are going to end up north of 70 bushel beans. And you have to look at that gross dollar per acre number and say, you know, when we can look at gross dollars in the $600 to $700 plus dollar range on beans, we have to take that while it's here. And if you want re-ownership, spend some of that money and buy some calls out into the March to maybe see how the South American weather season is going to progress. But the cash market and the basis market is screaming that they want your beans right now. That doesn't mean that we're going to peak out in price, but it's telling you there is a disincentive to store beans right now. Corn is starting to get like that. The spreads are starting to narrow. The basis is strong. It's phenomenal how strong these cash and futures markets are right through the middle of what still is likely a record corn harvest and near record bean harvest. So it's just mind-boggling how strong this is. But the same situation applies to corn, in my opinion, in that depending on what your yields are, and it's highly variable depending on where you're at in the corn belt in the country, look at that gross dollar per acre number that is offered right now. And again, if you want some paper ownership, do that. There's maybe a little more incentive to still some carry in the market to store some corn. But boy, the bean market, in my mind, is just a no-brainer that it's telling you they want your beans right now. Don't store them. We're actually going to disincentivize you. We're going to make it you spend money to store these beans right now. And oftentimes, you know, we need to listen to the cash market, and that's what it's telling us in the beans.
Merrill Crowley, 2020 can be really good hindsight. What were the fundamentals that drove us to this point? Are they still in place? And are there things that are going to change, in your opinion?
Demand from China was the big player. They hadn't been buying. It looked like we were going to go through harvest with a minimal amount of beans to China, and suddenly they started buying heavily. We also had some dry weather, and then the stocks report. You couple that all together, and it changed the situation from a burdensome supply area to one of needing to ration the supply. Also, we're looking at dry weather in South America. The forecast last week was saying that we were going to get scattered rains down there. We did get scattered rains this week, and those rains are supposed to increase. Now, will they? That's a $10,000 question. So I just think that the demand was the main reason. If that demand were to go away, we'd still be tight. But it could bring the bean rally to a quick end.
Mike Zuzlow, I wrote down when you were giving me the list, just demand rationing, and then a question mark after it, because I was thinking about the ending stocks for both corn and soybeans and wondering why we would need to demand ration,
exactly.
Right?
But, exactly. I'm in the exact same situation. Like, are these USDA numbers right yet? Because the market, and I know part of this goes back to the future side. I mean, you're talking about China's corn futures being at 960. So maybe it's not so much USDA and what's going on here in the United States, supply demand. Maybe it's USDA can't get a bead on what's going on in some of these key countries. And going back to Merrill's point, that and I think the Fed policy, you know, we had such a macro shift and then we had the demand come in from China. And you got to wonder, are they really buying because it's President Trump? Are they really buying because they need it? And I think that is what you've got to kind of keep in the back of your mind as far as, OK, are we slowing down too quickly economically because COVID gets worse and that offsets China's demand? And the market has done a good job of rationing these prices.
So you're of the mind that USDA just doesn't have their world ag supply and demand estimate ending stocks numbers correct?
Well, I really question whether I think the wheat and the corn numbers are the most suspect right now, Todd, because the wheat and the corn have been the most surprising to the trade. Merrill talking about South America's supply shortfall. That makes a lot of sense, and why USDA keeps bumping up China's imports for soybeans, and now at 100 million tons. I still question whether they'll take all that, or if they do, whether they'll re-export it to some of our normal customers, because I still don't think they're healed up in their livestock industry. But yeah, for corn and wheat, I really wonder if USDA really has a bead on what's happened in China at this point.
And I want to follow up with you because you're closer to wheat country than we are, or a lot of wheat country. How about that? Producers having problems getting wheat in the ground?
Yeah, and yet at the same time, they don't know what else to do because they think at this point they're just going to go ahead and put it in. If we don't get any rain through the holidays, it's probably not going to germinate when it comes out of dormancy, and they'll probably go after Milo because our Milo prices west of me and not too far from me, normally they're 40 to 60 cents under corn prices. They're 40 to 60 over the corn right now. And so there is a really good crop to turn to next spring if their wheat doesn't come up.
Chip Nellinger, we'll stay with wheat for just a second because as Mike just explained, and as we know from talking to the meteorologist during the week on the closing market report, wheat in the Great Plains states, hard red, is in trouble, sowing that is, because of dry weather conditions. That's also the case in the world's largest export area, Russia, the Black Sea, and Ukraine. What does this tell you about the global marketplace, if anything?
Todd, I think one thing that is happening is that you mentioned some of the problems in Russia and Ukraine, the problems in Kansas and the U.S. plains. Also, Argentina, with their growing crop, has been very, very dry. Maybe there's been some damage there. For the first time in a long, long time, the wheat market finally has a friendly story. And I think that's one of the reasons that the corn market is able to rally as easily as it has. We've had some things in the past, a year ago with prevent plant. We've had some bullish scenarios in the last couple of years with corn, but there's been such a glut of wheat in the world that it's held corn back. And now finally, you're starting to see some little flare-ups here in the plains and in the rest of the world that maybe there's starting to be a story for wheat. If you throw away the fundamentals, just forget what the story is right now. It's dry in areas. Look at a long-term monthly wheat chart, and it's a little bit scary. Looks to me like we formed a bottom in this chart and that there could be plenty of upside. Just looking at the chart, not knowing anything about fundamentals, rainfall, world supply and demand, the wheat chart itself from a monthly perspective, to me, looks maybe the most supportive of anything and maybe has the most room to run. And obviously, that's going to spill over and help corn out. But it is the wheat market, so as I say this, we'll probably be down 20 tomorrow. That's just the way the wheat market works. But over the long haul, I think the wheat could be a little bit of a sleeper in here, especially if these dry weather areas in the Black Sea and the U.S. plains continue.
Merrill, which of the three crops, corn, soybeans, or wheat, do you think have the most strength left in them? And or which one can or should be the leader?
Yeah, that's a good question because I really don't know which one to pick. There's so many variables. Right now, the beans are leading. They could continue. Let's say we get wait a little, another week or two, and then get rain in South America. Well, that's going to kind of mess up their safrinha crop of corn. So maybe they'll go with more beans down there because the bean price is higher. Then we come into the U.S. for next spring, and the beans are still high-priced. And we start switching acres over to beans and leaving corn out. Well, that would say, okay, corn would turn into your leader. Well, if we don't get the rain here in the U.S., we don't get the rain in Russia, we don't get the rain in Argentina, then your wheat crop's not getting planted. It's not going to be very large, and your wheat crop could end up being leader. Typically, most big bull markets are led by wheat. So, right now, I think beans have seen the larger share of the rally, and depending on how the weather pans out, it could find a top in here somewhere soon. But you're looking at a 6.8% stocks to use, and that's tight. You could have another 3-4 million metric tons off of the original amount. I think it was around 35 million metric tons they said China was going to take. Well, every 3 million metric tons is another 100 million bushels of beans. You could see possibly rain delaying the soybean planting enough so that the 9 million metric tons that China has bought from Brazil cannot be handled in the Jan-Feb time period that it's meant to be shipped, and they may have to come to this country for another 100 million. Well, now, out of the 290 million, you're down to 90 million carryout, which is more like a 1 or 2% stocks to use. That is extremely tight. So I look at these figures and say, okay, they're all good. They all have potential to move higher. So it gets back to, okay, what do I want to make money in? If I'm making money in soybeans right now, do I do like Chip suggested and go ahead and price and try to re-own them? And I think that's a good idea. You, for beans, for example, if you can sell $10 beans right now, it costs you 50 cents to buy a May 1040 call this morning with May trading around 1030 something. Well, I could put that in storage for cheaper than I can put that 50 cents into an option, be like 30, 35 cents in storage. But I can have $10 beans, spend 50 cents on the call option, still have $9.50 to work my finances. And to me, and it puts a floor in the market. And to me, that's the way to go with the beans. But I just have a hard time picking which of the three.
Let's talk a little bit about marketing corn. We've managed, I think, to get through beans pretty thoroughly. What should producers, Mike Zuzlow, do with corn at this time?
I think that works into your previous question. For me, I think the corn is a better cash crop to store. Chip talked about the carry in the market and how we're removing that. I think we can continue to do that, Todd, with the idea that USDA took our soybean production below 2018 levels. I think our corn needs to go below 2018 production levels as well. So I think there's still a couple 300 million bushels there that we could shave off the production. I say that because I think corn on corn acres have been disappointing. And I say that because more than one client in all the different types of states, in fact, I talked to two just today, one in Illinois and one in Nebraska, both of them telling me their corn was a bit disappointing, not so much because of the weather, but because they shaved off of their inputs. They started to cut prices or cut their cost of production back because the prices were so poor until they got into the July-August timeframe. So I think corn, from a standpoint of the carrying charge that's still in the market that could be erased, the production number, USDA has not fattened the demand side up nearly like they have with the soybeans. I think there's several reasons, and to Merrill's point about the stocks-to-use ratios, you know, the global corn stocks-to-use ratios are back down to the drought years. You know, they're back down to the 2012-2013 time period. So if we do tighten up the wheat supplies further, that still makes corn even better. Why? Because again, Chinese corn futures are at $9.60, U.S. corn futures are at $4. So, I mean, it's an amazing price difference between what even Paris corn is at $5.50. So when I look at the price of corn on the board here in the United States versus all the other major exchanges, it really shows some daylight for the corn if the wheat can keep it charged.
Chip, your best advice on corn?
I think Mike did a good overview of that. I would say it's dependent on where you're at because the yields are so varied this year. If you're in an area that's blessed with record or near record yields, and there are some of those out there, I think you have to, again, look at gross revenue. You know, it's amazing. 75 days ago, the market was expecting a potential for a 4 billion bushel corn carryout. We're now going to be at or maybe slightly under, to Mike's argument, 2 billion bushels. Amazing turn of events. And the gross revenue is there. If you have on-farm storage, there's enough carry that it pays. The basis is historically strong in some areas, even right in the gut slot of harvest right now. So it's tough to put a general recommendation out there. I think it depends on where you're at, how much storage you have, what your individual yield situation is. But one thing's for certain, there are basis opportunities, and there are opportunities staring us in the face today. So don't stick your head in the sand thinking that this $4 plus level is going to necessarily last forever, or that we're on our way to $4.50 or $5. the revenue's there, and each individual situation is slightly different, but there's opportunities right now, immediately.
Merrill, anything on corn?
We went corn and looked at your sample size for the USDA, and they were right at 91% on their sample size versus last year's about 68%. I'm sorry, 93% on sample size versus last year's 78% at this time. That suggests that the corn yields are pretty well narrowed in. Yes, we could see some lighter test weights start to develop here later, lighter ear weights. On the soybeans, we're not as far advanced on our sample size, and that leaves the possibility that the soybeans yield could increase, because from what I'm seeing with yield, I think the general USDA total crop of soybeans per bushel will increase possibly on the November report. What do I want to do with corn? I think the market's basically saying you should probably price it here. If you need to carry it or want to carry it, you have a 14 to 17 cents carry in the market. It's going to cost you roughly 30 to 35 cents of commercial storage to carry it over there. And the call options at the money for a May call option was running about 25 cents today. So, it's easier to handle the corn price per bushel and store it and carry it out. And I think the bigger story for corn comes later in the spring, or maybe even summer for next year.
Let's get a final word from each of you now. I'll start with you, Mike Zuzulo.
I think the biggest thing to watch here, Todd, in the very short term, meaning the next week or so, heading into the election, other than what we've talked about in the outside markets, is I think the USDA report and then the reaction by the market has shown us that soybeans are kind of at a tipping point here with having priced in a lot of premium. And for them to go higher, it needs wheat and corn at this stage. And I still think that's the case. I think that you're going to find out whether beans have real sustainability above 1045, 1040 area, which is very key support monthly speaking. Because we don't close above 1040 very often, and so on a monthly basis. So I think if you get a weather pattern change in Brazil, and we start to see some of these dry areas get rain, and the beans start to give way, corn and wheat are going to need to be there to support it.
Chip Nellinger?
Todd, I think to Mike's point and to Merrill's point, there's a lot of bullishness built in here, and there's also a lot of risk ahead. There's an election. There's a massive amount of weather uncertainty and premium in prices, corn, beans, and wheat at this stage. And there's good gross revenue right staring us in the face. So I think it's more important than ever to have a plan, have a risk management plan, execute it, and don't underestimate the risk that's there. If this weather starts turning for the better and South America plants 2 to 3% more bean acres and doesn't have a weather problem, it doesn't matter what our carrot is. We're going to have a big competition from the Southern Hemisphere come February, March, April. So I guess my advice is look at your gross revenue, have a plan to lock some of this in. There's tremendous amount of risk going ahead in the next 90 days with election and weather and world production. And boy, it's high time to execute a risk management plan.
Merrill Crowley.
You know, I agree. Chip really hit the nail on the head with that. Let's take care of the risk now. You can always, reestablish risk. It was just 2 months ago we wondered what we were going to sell our corn and beans at with the lows just being in August two months ago. So I think we've got a lot to look forward to. I think we need to keep our heads on our shoulders, keep it straight, take the money that's being given to you. If you want to re-own it and put some back on the market at risk, use your futures market. And then keep an eye out on 2021. There's going to be some attractive prices out there, I think, before all this is over. And if you're concentrating on this year too much, you forget to take advantage of some good prices for next year.
And Danielle Anderson is still with us. She, again, is the Vice President of the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association and a Director of Government and Public Relations at Marquess Energy. Your final word, please.
Yes, the ethanol industry, like I said, we saw a 50% production drop from plummeting fuel demand due to COVID. But we are seeing improvements, and we will keep pushing for initiatives to drive long-term demand. We know that ethanol is the immediate solution to combat greenhouse gas emissions. And this is very appealing for legislation in Illinois and to our congressional leaders. So the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association and corn growers, the ethanol companies, we're beating our drum, and we are optimistic our product will be in high demand. And we're also very fortunate here in Illinois to be on the Illinois waterway system, be on the Illinois River, and we're going to keep working on these markets, on these international markets, and getting our product over there as well.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org or look it up in your favorite podcast applications. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Merrill Crowley of First Choice Commodities from Watseka, Illinois, Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri Marketing out of Morton, Illinois, Mike Zuzulo from GlobalComResearch.com from Atchison, Kansas, and our special guest for the day, Danielle Anderson of Hennepin, Illinois. She's the Director of Government and Public Relations for Marquess Energy and a Vice President of the Illinois Renewable Fuels Association. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.